Welcome to Doc Talks Fishing, where science and fishing make a big splash. Join Gord and Liam with this week's guest.
All right. I am very excited about today's guest. We have Nick Bacante coming on. He's a biologist, and he's one of the guys that literally wrote the book on walleyes. He's extremely knowledgeable on the species. And, I mean, we're going to talk early season walleye today, and some of the stuff is going to be mind-blowing.
I'll tell you a little secret. Nick and I go back probably 30 years plus, and we're good friends. And I'm going to remind him of this when we do the podcast today, because I worked in the ADM's office, the deputy minister's office, in Thunder Bay when I was with OM&R. And the honest reality is, I mean, I'm briefing ministers and cabinet and dealing on the policy side. And I used to sneak out and I'd go up for coffee. I would go up to meet Nick and Dr. Peter Colby. And they headed up the Walleye Research Unit for Ontario. And that was my sanctuary. So I used to drive them crazy because I'd get out of the boring policy side of fish and wildlife, and I'd go and sit with Nick, and they'd be talking about researching mayflies and researching what walleyes were eating. And our main walleye research for Ontario was at the Savan Lake areas. So everything that was happening in the walleye world, I was exposed to firsthand, and Peter Colby and Dominic Nick Bacante, who we're going to talk to today, in my view, are two of the most respected walleye biologists managers in the world. This is such a unique opportunity. So what do you say? Let's welcome Nick in. And Nick, I'm going to drive you crazy today. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Gordon and Liam. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're so looking forward to having you here with us.
I am too. It's been a while since we actually talked face to face. We, you know, you kept in touch with the odd email now and then, you know, asking questions, and I make up answers, send them back to you. And
yeah, I've done several Outdoor Canada features and In Fisherman features with you. And I mean, honest truth, when I think of walleye biology and folks who understand walleye, I know I'm going to make you blush, but I there's not very many people in the world who have studied walleyes more than you have. And Nick, I thought before we were going to focus on spring walleye behavior today, but I thought before we did that, it'd be really cool to hear you talk a little bit about just all those many years of studying the fish. But they're found from Alabama to the Arctic Ocean. I mean, that makes them just so extremely adaptable.
Yeah, it's a good, I mean, I can't think of too many other species, at least in the freshwater side, where they span such a huge amount of the landscape. And I mean, when you think about, like you said, down to the Gulf of Mexico, Louisiana, all the way up to the Arctic Circle, and everything in between, mostly through the Midwest, you know, that's kind of the core. And then on the east side, and then the west, of course, as you know, it kind of, we're at the edge of walleye distribution right here where I am. Of course, there's been a few introductions here and there, like the Columbia River, but you know, they're not native there at all. But when you look at the native range, it is pretty astounding, because when you look at the kind of differences in environmental conditions that they have to survive in and adapt, you know, obviously it's taken many years for adaptation to work, but it is pretty incredible. So they're more resilient and adaptive. Well, most animals are, than we give them credit or we think about, you know, but walleye for sure. And of course, as you know better than me, in terms of the economic benefits that come with that big distribution. You know, it's one of the main sport fish. And I can't imagine, we talked about them many times during our research, you know, the economic benefits that walleye populations have. And that's usually the arguments that the political side of things like to talk about, because ultimately, you know, what's it worth for us to manage this fish? You know, of course, we're thinking about the ecology and their place in, you know, maintaining a balanced ecosystem, but it does have direct economic benefits as well that we all know, right?
Yeah. What fascinates me, there's just so many things, Nick, but, you know, here we are, spring, walleye anglers are getting their boats ready. Opening day has either come for some parts of the country or it's about to open. And most of early season focuses around where walleye have recently spawned or are about to spawn. I'll bet most anglers aren't aware of the fact that a young walleye, a first-time spawning walleye, really doesn't even know where to go. It actually learns that, does it not, from more mature fish?
Yes, I mean, to what extent? There's probably a number of factors, you know. We tend, of course, talk about the ones we understand, but, you know, we don't know what we don't know, right? And it's probably a combination of things. But for sure, the behavioral side of things is very important. That's why we've always talked and promoted the idea of maintaining a balanced population in terms of the age groups, because those older walleyes have a lot of learned behavior in terms of where feeding grounds are, spawning grounds are. And as you know, walleye are a schooling fish. You know, they tend to congregate in schools at different times of the year. And spawning is one of those physiological requirements that the fish has to go through. And for the most part, if you're young walleye just coming into maturity, in the age of maturity, and you start to get the pheromones and all the cues that you have that tells you that you should be looking for spawning grounds, you're right. You know, how do you do that? And so the schooling behavior is very important. And of course, they tend to follow the older mature fish. But there's probably other factors like chemical pheromones release. You know, we know animals have those kinds of adaptations as well. So that's important. To what extent that plays a role, I mean, we don't know. But for sure, we know that the behavioral side of things is very important. So, yeah, and again, like I said, it's not just for the spawning, during the spawning time, but it's also important identifying preferred prey species. You know, the ones that are schooling and walleye will go towards where these schooling prey fish are. And so that's another thing where it's important, you know. So, yeah, you're right, because that's, you know, outlines the importance of maintaining a balanced population with those older mature fish. You know, their value is more than just beyond having large fish and producing large number of eggs. It's got that behavioral aspect to it as well.
And I was just going to ask that too, is like everybody knows that big fish are extremely important. One, for good genetics, but two, they lay a lot of eggs. But you're now saying that they actually basically educate the younger fish.
Oh, for sure, yeah. They don't put them in old folks home like they do with us, right? they actually value we should be careful about not talking about fish like they go through the same thought process we do, you know. But it's you know, animals in general, they respond to stimuli, it's a behavioral thing, you know, it's inbred in them. But no, for sure, they respond to that. And that's why it's so important to maintain that balanced age structure population, age structure in the population, because it has all kinds of implication. And that's why sometimes we see demise of walleye population if we lose one age group or some age groups, you know, disproportionately to others. We know we don't have that balance in there anymore. So as biologists, you know, we tend to always talk about the balanced ecosystem. I mean, that's part of it. You know, you need to have all these components for it to work. So for sure, that's that becomes a learned behavior. Of course, you know, once the fish who are mature for the first time learn where the spawning grounds may be, you know, they've learned that, they've imprinted in them. Now they can go on after that, and then as new ones come in, you know, the cycle continues, right?
Yeah, that's I actually never realized that, Nick, that as they grow older, they're actually learning, and I say that in quotation marks, but I suppose by following those much more mature fish, that if it's a drought year or a high water year, I'm assuming those older mature walleye have adapted to the different conditions, and in effect, first or second year spawners are actually being imprinted and learning how to respond to those situations, eh?
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, the fish, in general, animals, they're very, again, quotation mark, aware of environmental conditions, and so they respond to stimuli, right? Temperature, it's a huge one, light, all bunch of stuff, the length of the day. But going to a spawning ground, of course, it encompasses all bunch of characteristics that are important, like the substrate, places where the eggs will remain oxygenated, you know, and there's the substrate, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on, in terms of protecting the eggs. You know, there's a bunch of qualities about the spawning grounds. You know, why do the older fish go there in the first place? Well, because obviously there's been success there. It's provided all the necessary conditions for the fish to spawn successfully. So over time, fish have selected for the more desirable spawning areas that have all those attributes, as opposed to going somewhere where their chance of egg survival would be next to none. You know, so yeah, all those things are kind of integrated, and they express themselves through the behavior, you know, of the older fish. They already know where to go there because they've experienced those kind of physiological responses, right?
Yeah.
Huh. So like Gord said, the younger fish, it may be beneficial to their success to look up to, if you will, the older fish in the lake, the more mature fish, larger fish, obviously. So does that mean in bodies of water where there are higher numbers of larger fish that the populations are, again, in quotations, more knowledgeable than lakes with where they are missing those large fish?
Yeah, Liam, I really hate to use a lot of those, what we say, anthropomorphic I think, because, you know, for us to understand that, we put it in the terms you understand. I don't know about knowledgeable, you know, fish and animal population in general, like I said, they respond to environmental stimuli, behavior. It's just that when we looked at that behavior, you know, we look at it in the terms that we understand, you know, kind of thing. So I don't know about how to use the term knowledgeable, but I think, again, goes back to the balance in the population, which is not just about the knowledge of the spawning ground, but it's a learned behavior, I would call it, because that's what it is. Yeah. It's a behavior that you learn through over the millennia, you know, trial and error, where you know, where things are successful, those are the things that tend, you know, will get imprinted in the fish. So it's right. Yes, it's important to understand the role of the older fish. And we should be concerned if we see a decline, disproportionate decline in those, but not for the reasons maybe that we kind of tend to look at through our eyes, but in terms of what the success, how it translates to successful reproduction and spawning and finding those spawning grounds. So ultimately, it translates into a viable and healthy population, right? Yeah. But you know, at the end, at the end, if we use those terms and we do the right thing, it doesn't matter what we call it, right? As long as we understand it, that's important, right? To me, that's...
Yeah, put them in quotations. Exactly, yeah.
I know this is a broad question, Nick, but what makes a great walleye spawning area? And it seems to differ from some lakes, rivers, reservoirs, but both from an angling perspective, because, you know, that's where so much of the fishing activity occurs in the spring, and also from a recruitment spawning perspective. But what makes a good walleye spawning area?
Well, one of the main, the top of the list, I would say, is the availability of things like oxygenated water, water that has enough dissolved oxygen in it. And just as an aside, oxygen dissolves in water at different rates. For example, warmer water does not hold, or is not capable of holding as much oxygen as colder water as well. That's a bit of an aside. So there's there's relationship there as well. So if we think about oxygen in the water as a key factor, then you look at, for example, creeks and rivers where walleye might spawn, and think, oh well, that's got to be a preferred habitat. Well, it's only preferred if it has moving water, as in riffles and rapids, you know, because that's what oxygenates the water, because there's lots of streams and rivers where there's no walleye spawning, you know. So it's not that it's obligatory that they go there. Now in lakes, for example, you say, well, where's the oxygenated water in the lakes? Well, typically as a general rule, they tend to spawn on the windward side of the lake. So in the spring, if you look at where the prevailing winds are coming from, if they're coming from the west, as they do here, on the eastern side of the lake, that's where you get a lot of wave action. As a matter of fact, the example of Charlie Lake here, which I've talked to many times, Gord, this, when I first came here, I didn't know the lake where they spawned and everything. So I started kind of looking at, we went out, we wanted to go out at night. I wanted to show some of the people here, because not many people had that experience. Take the flashlight late at night and go along the shore. And as you know, the walleye, the eyes of the walleye reflect quite a bit in the light. And so the lake, about 15 kilometers long, so it's a big enough lake. I said, where do you start? I said, well, let's start on the eastern side where there's rocks and clean substrate. Sure enough, you know, as soon as we get there, we find walleye right up close to shore. They're spawning. because the prevailing winds at that time of year come from the west, and they stir up the water, and there's clean substrate with rocks and all those nice spaces in between the rocks where the eggs can get protected. So if you were to go to the lake and you had no idea where to look, that would be the first thing that I would do. The winds, where they come from, then narrows it down somewhat. Then you look at the shoreline on the other side and look for the more desirable one, and then kind of narrows down one more. So that's one important consideration. And as I said, you know, oxygen is one component, and also you don't want, for example, that spawning habitat to be prone to sedimentation, you know, because even if it was in the creek, rivers and creeks, of course, they carry heavy sediment loads sometimes, and they tend to deposit, the sediment tends to deposit when you have a change in velocity, the velocity slows down. So the walleye, like any other fish, have learned to select for those sites where those things don't happen, you know, where the substrate stays clean and well oxygenated. So the substrate and the presence of highly oxygenated water, of course, it's important. And not just at the time they're actually releasing the eggs, because those eggs, now they have to incubate and spawn, so they have to survive a bunch of conditions. And I mean, fish is not going to know if you have unusual dry year or there's water being withdrawn that drops the water, you know, they've learned that behavior over thousands of years. That's why it's important for us now to introduce those highly variable events, like, for example, maybe withdrawing water or the kinds of things that we're seeing through the climate change. I mean, we had about 3 days of rain here last year, right? So the water levels right now are the lowest. I've been just getting a lot of data from the city that they have a weir to maintain the daily water levels, and just did some graphing of that, and it's the lowest it's ever been, right? So unless we don't have any snow here now. So unless things change, you know, it might be a challenge next year, for example, because one of a friend of mine that lives right along the shore where the walleye spawn, that's the most exposed beach she's ever seen there in years. So that could have implications, right?
Wow. Yeah. Nick, rocks and stones, the cracks and crevices, and I know you call them interstitial spaces, I believe.
We have to have hard to pronounce names so that we're legitimate.
but what are they're extremely critical though, Nick? If the eggs are exposed, they're vulnerable. Yeah. But if they wash into those cracks and crevices, they're protected.
Exactly, and let's not forget, it's not just for the fish, but you know, when you look at a lot of the insects. That, you know, we tend to see insects at the adult stage when they're flying around, like the mayfly, but most of those insects come from larval stages that have developed in the water. And if you go digging around some of the substrates, you'll see a lot of larval stage insects, like the stoneflies and mayflies and those other things. So, those spaces are important not only for protection of the eggs from predation and other environmental events, but also for the food base. Many times those insects are the food base for the walleye and other fish. So of course, predation, as we mentioned, it's always a worry, because any bottom feeding fish potentially could feed on walleye eggs. And you know, after all, they're another biological food source full of proteins, right? And I think, you know, it's worth noting that over my career, you know, one fish that has always had a bad reputation for this has been the sucker, right? Whether white sucker, long-nose sucker, can't tell you the number of times walked in the room and people are blaming suckers for everything that's wrong in the world, you know? And, you know, people forget that... let's say white sucker, which is the most popular species, the other species as well, they actually, you know, they tend to think of them as kind of trash fish type of thing, no value. Everything has a value to something, not just because it doesn't have value to you. You know, you can look at it through that. And white sucker, for example, they also require highly oxygenated water, you know, high standards of, so they're also an indicator of good environmental conditions, because if the suckers are there spawning, it means that the environmental conditions are suitable, right? And in many times, I don't know if you're familiar, Gordon, if you remember, but I remember Minnesota, I had friends worked there, and they had some lakes where they tried to restore walleye population, and they were trying everything they could to decimate the sucker population. The problem there is not the sucker itself, is that the fish community had come so out of balance that the sucker dominated because the predator had gone, you know. So, you know, people tend to blame the sucker, but it wasn't. It was whatever the things that made that community go out of whack, that was the main factor that you need to focus on, because just removing the sucker, if you don't have the conditions for walleye to come back, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Anyway, the short story on that one is they weren't very successful, because, of course, suckers are very prolific, and when you start to remove them, like Modaita fish, and we can talk about this later, they respond to exploitation and they just produce more eggs, you know. And that's an important thing to understand. You know, there's other species as well, you know, the ciscos, whitefish, burbot. I mean, anything can feed on walleye eggs as they can on any other eggs. You know, like I said, they're just a biological source of food, you know. But I think that many times we tend to key on those as the reason why something may not working, where the underlying reason behind it is it's something else altogether, right, that has allowed it to go to that place, right?
Have you ever wondered what it takes for soft plastic baits to truly uphold the Rapala legacy? As an angler since childhood, Rapala has been a part of the entire journey. I want to welcome you to Crush City, a destination in the mind of every angler where the fish are big and the bite is hot. After meticulous testing, I can confidently say that the Crush City soft plastics live up to the legacy. With superior shapes, action, and scent, these baits have become the go-to for myself and other avid multi-species anglers, ultimately putting more fish in the boat or on the ice. The smart injection technology combines custom combinations of color, flake, salt, and scent that are added precisely where needed for the perfect presentation. Experience the difference for yourself. You can try the family-priced Crush City soft plastics and discover Crush City.
Nick, roughly, how many eggs does a female walleye lay? Okay,
I'm curious,
how many eggs does a female lay? And I know you've looked at how many percentage-wise might hatch, and out of those, I'm assuming hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, how many actually do you think make it to adulthood? I mean, probably the worst thing you could be in life is a walleye egg.
Yeah. Well, and other ones as well, but you might have to end up shutting me up on this one, Gore, because it's one of my favorite topics, right? Because I spent about 5-6 years studying walleye fecundity because that we didn't have long-term study. I mean, there have been studies here and there, you know, looking at walleye production, you know, but we actually did it over a period of about 5-6 years, and we were actually, because we were manipulating the walleye population, we had the benefit in looking at the response, how the things that we were doing might influence the egg production. So just as a general rule, egg production varies tremendously, same as maturity, growth, and lifespan, given what we said before in terms of how far ranged the walleye are. I mean, if you think about, actually, there's a great map and the chapter that we did on that book that I mentioned to you, Gord, some time ago, one of the most updated ones on walleye and sauger, the chapter I worked with Nigel Lester and Mike Bosak. There's a beautiful map, one of the only colorful maps in the book, and it shows the range of the walleye, also shows the energy in terms of, we use something called growing degree days above 5 Celsius. And what that does is there's different bases that people use depending on your interest, but above 5 Celsius essentially was a way to signify that, you know, biological activity will start above 5 Celsius, you know, when you start to get things happening in nature. So we wanted to see, use that as an indicator to correlate with all bunch of life history events for the walleye. And when you look at that map that I mentioned, if you look down from the sort of waters into the Gulf of Mexico, you're talking about, just to give you an idea, around 5,000 growing degree days per year. And when you go up to the Arctic, you're less than 1,000, right? And, you know, maybe that might not seem like a lot to people, but when you look at the implications of that, it's a tremendous amount of difference, because you're thinking about spawning temperatures, you know, incubation temperatures developing and stuff, and all, and walleye population around the range have developed all kinds of strategy, and egg production is one of them. So egg production generally, if I wanted to put some numbers around it, they can vary anywhere from about just the absolute number, maybe 20,000 to 200,000 eggs.
Wow.
And again, that depends on the population. And also, and I think as a follow-up, you might want to look at, in case you need more details, if you look at that chapter, that I also got the graph where it shows the egg production by age groups for different populations, going from Lake Erie all the way up to northern Manitoba and everything in between. That will give you a really good sense. Now, those are absolute numbers. In terms of relative egg production, let's say eggs per kilogram, we're talking about anywhere from about 40,000. And again, these are broad because they can vary quite a bit. But 40,000 eggs per kilogram of fish in the northern part, and maybe 80,000, double that, about 80,000 eggs per kilogram in middle latitudes. Now, the interesting thing about this, you think, well, in the far south, they might produce a huge number of eggs. Not necessarily, because the waters don't get cool enough for them to produce the eggs. The fish have to be exposed to sufficient cool water. I mean, after all, it's called a cool water species, right? Enough cool water to develop those gametes, and which lead to egg production, right? So in the southern population, that's actually, we're getting to the physiological extreme of that species, because sometimes the water does not cool down enough for the egg production to take place. And that's why now when we talk about things like long-term climate change and all the rest of it, can have implication in terms of not just walleye, but any other species distribution, because when the water are not longer suitable for them to be in it, because of temperature shifts, these are the kinds of things, right? Because fish have physiological limits. And so that's kind of the egg production. And in terms of survival, yes, it is super high mortality from egg to, and I'm just looking at, I put this table in front of me because I think it's the only one that I've seen where we have this kind of data. We had Savannah Lake, which, you know, where I work. We had this data where we knew everything. Well, we estimated everything from the number of eggs produced, how many fish at age 0, 1, 2, 1. So we had a really good idea. And the only other lake that we had that to is one in northern Wisconsin called Escanaba Lake, which I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's had since World War II, I think, you know, it's had continuous data. It's a lake, it's open to fishing, and it's open year-round, but they have one research station where you come in, I think it's part of a park, and so they know everything in terms of the anglers. It's a great data set. And a good friend of mine there that unfortunately died way too early, Steve Searns, he's got a bunch of really good papers. We compare the stuff all the time, and I've got the data on Escanaba Lake as well. And just to give you an idea, a sense of scale. So Savannah Lake, I've got egg production probably somewhere around 83, 84 million eggs total. By age zero, which is from the time they hatch, you're looking at about 10,000 fish. So it's about 99% mortality. Now, in general, fish that, you know, if they live in more dynamic, warmer environments, they tend to produce more eggs because there's a much higher mortality. So typically when a fish has produce a large number of eggs, means that there's probably a good chance that there's high mortality from egg to survival. And if you look at things like cold water fish, like I always was jealous of guys who work in salmonids because they didn't have that many eggs to count like we did. You know, they're bigger and their orders of magnitude less number of eggs in trouts and salmon that there is in. And then, of course, you feel sorry for the guys that might work on perch or crappie or the other end of the scale, right? But, you know, give an idea, over 90%, 99% easily mortality from egg to hatching.
Wow.
And real quick, and I can send these to you in case you wanted to get some of these numbers, but you're looking at, you know, 10,000 age one, age zero, about 7,000 age one, five, four. By the time you get to where you start to get mature, you're down to 2,000 fish, you know, 2,000 fish in there. So it's a huge mortality gradient there that you have. That's why they have to produce the number of eggs. And that's why, like you said, Liam, the importance of the larger fish that produce eggs, because you might think, oh, well, they produce 200,000 eggs. Well, that's great, yeah, but over 99% of those don't make it, right? So there's
Do you think the lakes that have, and I'm just going to relate back to what you were saying about passing down the knowledge. There I go again, using the word
knowledge.
I know
what you mean. It's okay.
The listeners know what I mean too. But just to relate back to that, because I loved that. Do you think lakes that have lower numbers of large fish, like say it's a heavily fished lake and there aren't a lot of those large mature fish, do those lakes, without the influence of the older fish, have higher mortality rate?
Mortality, like overall, or from the eggs?
Like, would lakes with higher numbers of larger fish be able to pass down the information needed to have lower mortality rate in the egg yields?
No, I don't think there's any cue or any sort of genetic factor in terms of passing that. I mean, fish, you know, each age group of fish is only able to respond based on their physiological characteristics. So larger fish they will produce more eggs because they can, and that's what their physiology allows. But the mortality is still very high. It's just now that you have a lot of eggs produced, but there's also more eggs that don't make it. Just in terms of the numbers game, it's important to have those walleye, because even though the mortality is high, they still produce a lot on a relative scale. They still produce a lot of eggs. And, you know, there isn't really anything that younger or smaller walleye can benefit from larger or older walleyes being there, other than, you know, from the sense that their physiology cannot change whether those large walleyes are there or not. You're still limited by your body size. You're still limited by your, you know, your physiological ability to produce the number of eggs you produce. So that doesn't change. I mean, that varies somewhat based on environmental conditions, but that it's across the population. So it's not that, some larger fish may be impacted more by environmental conditions because they may be more, susceptible to warmer temperature, for example, or large temperature changes. But there's some innate physiological limits, for example, the hatching rates of eggs, because whether you produce a lot or a few, if the conditions, it becomes a survival game from the day the egg is put on the substrate, because then you've got temperature variation. And my good friend Steve Cerns there, he did some great work looking at hatching rates based on warming rates of temperature and how important those spring temperatures are to determining the year class strength of walleye, which is something that we may not get to, Gord, but walleye are typically, they're very well known for having highly variable year class strength, meaning the number that make it through from one particular year class from one to the next may be highly variable, and usually you can trace it back to springtime warming rates or cooling rates or variation in temperature during the time that the eggs are being hatched, you know, before they hatch.
So, yeah, right, 100%. Well, we see that on Lake of the Woods all the time. We're from Lake of the Woods, and just, I mean, fishing from year to year to year, you can obviously see that there are those significant year classes.
Yeah.
Some years will catch a huge majority of 24-inch fish. And then, just as an example, and the next year, obviously, those fish are slightly larger. But you can see those age classes where you'll catch fish smaller and larger, but a very significant portion are all cookie cutters.
Yeah, and I mean, angling fisheries are a perfect example where you can see that, because anglers, they're kind of provide a window into the year class because they tend to be fairly selective. You know, the anglers, so if you catch all of a sudden one year, you're catching the fishing is good this year, right? What's that mean? Means probably that you have a strong year class that's coming through in that window where they're vulnerable to anglers. So the strong year class coming through and the fishing becomes good. And the fishing is the pits because you've had year class failures. So the walleye probably more than, well, for, you know, in terms of the cool water world, it's probably not unusual because of the high variability that we talked about in terms of the temperature and all the stuff that can affect this fish. They tend to be much more variable. You know, for example, with some monads, you know, they're spawning, they're fall spawners. Temperature don't tend to, they're in an environment where they don't experience the same extreme temperatures like walleye do, right? Because you're talking about walleye in shallow water in the spring, very variable in the fall, before things are cooling down, you know, and you're in deeper water, you're not going to be susceptible to those same kind of environmental variations like walleye are, right? So that's why you see a lot of the effects of a strong and weak year class, particularly when you're fishing, because that's very typical of what happens in walleye fishing.
We're proud to have Williams Lures as one of our podcast partners. Whether you're fishing for brookies, bass, or walleyes, lake trout, northern pike, or muskies, you can always find a Williams spoon for the occasion. They're precision crafted in Sherbrooke, Quebec, and every one is a testament to quality. For over a century, Williams has adorned their spoons with jewelry-grade silver and 24-karat gold. That not only ensures longevity, but provides unparalleled flash that captivates even the wariest fish. When you're planning your next fishing trip, be sure to put Williams spoons into your tackle box.
What, I know we touched on this slightly, but what is it that directly influences one of those good years? Because I know you mentioned warmer years or cooler years. Is it the warmer years that are better or the cooler years?
Well, it's not, I don't think we can neatly package it, because there's a bunch of insidious little things, like it's more the rate, you know, the rate of warming, the rate of cooling. For example, take yourself, if you're an egg, and this is being established, well established in lab experiments, where they look at the optimum, what's the optimum cooling or warming rates, you know. So when I say rate, I mean the number of degrees temperature change per unit time, you know. So if you're a walleye egg and you just being deposited in the substrate, now you're going to experience a gradual, sort of theoretical side, a gradual increase in temperature, so that you know the egg can start to develop the embryo and everything else. Now imagine yourself if you had, as we do in Canada, you know very well, you might have beautiful weather. Everybody goes out in shorts, and then the next week it gets snow, especially if you're in Calgary, right? And so that has huge implications on some of these eggs that are there. And this is a work go back to Steve Cerns. He actually, you know, we're able to look at those temperature changes based on the rates, and we can start to draw some direct lines between those and the air class strength of walleye. So you can predict from that, you know, whether it's going to be a good or bad year. And this is something that, I know you guys are doing a great job, you know, trying to educate anglers to think more like scientists. You know, we got this big movement of data science. You know, people have got apps to record everything that goes on around the world. But you know, it's a great thing. You know, if anglers, especially professional anglers who are this all the time, start to pay attention, you know, what the conditions are, for example, in the spring, and then make some prediction about what's fishing going to be like 4 or 5 years from now, depending on where you are. And, you know, and I think over time, if there's enough people doing that, you can build, you know, you tend to build up a better understanding of what's going on, you know, and that, to me, it's probably something not underrated, but I think it's anglers in general, they may not think about this as much because they might focus on the number of eggs we produce or the number of big fish, but there's so many insidious little weaklings along the way that can, you know, determine what population and ultimately fishing success is. So the I would say that generally the rate of change of temperatures is a key one, because if you have wild fluctuation in that, that can reduce, you know, that can have a disastrous effect on the air class strength. And of course, there's all the other stuff too, you know, whether you've got water levels or sedimentation or predation. I mean, everything is out to kill you. You know, it's a survival game, right? And generally speaking, I would say if I had to key on one thing for walleye, I would say that springtime water temperature fluctuations is probably a real key factor in determining how successful that year class is going to be.
One of those other factors, Nick, I believe, and it's I think one of the classic biology predator prey relationships is walleye and yellow perch. And in fact, a walleye is the biggest member of the perch family. And yes, yellow perch do feed on the walleye eggs, but because the walleye eggs hatch first and then the yellow perch hatch afterwards, in our part of the country, certainly here in central Canada, northern Ontario, young of the year perch are absolutely critical, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, to survival of young of the year walleyes. And the other thing I'm really curious about is how important are juvenile perch, say 3, 4, 5 inch perch, to adult walleyes as prey? And because the perch eat walleye eggs, do you think there's ever a revenge factor that for bigger walleyes, when they see those smaller perch, they pay them back for eating their eggs? Or is that really anthropomorphic thinking?
We'll deal with that one first, because absolutely there's no such thing as revenge, you know. They're not human fish. We are the only ones that do revenge killings. No, not at all. I mean, like I said, what drives animal population in general is stimuli and respond, behavioral response, and all kinds of stuff. So, I don't think that term even applies to large mammals, right? It's just something that we tend to think of it. But you're right, though, in terms of the importance of perch. Now, again, perch are only important in walleye lakes where there is perch and walleye, because there's lots of walleye lakes where there is no perch and they still manage to do fine. But you know, your typical, what I call Walleye, perch, white sucker, maybe burbot, a few minnow species, and some places you have cisco, some places you have not, you know, but typically walleye and perch are always there, you know, despite which other, the other species are there. Now at Savannah, we were pretty lucky because we were able to do a lot of work on every aspect of the life history. And one of the things that we did every year, we look at, we caught young of the year walleye from the time that we were able to catch them. So the walleye that were hatched in that spring, we would start about July or so. We would use these seine nets at the beach, and we had stations set up where we would catch walleye and other fish species and look at this. And we also looked at the food of the young walleye in the stomach, and I can tell you that for the first probably couple of months from the time that walleye were big enough to start feeding, they would mostly feed on plankton, you know, daphnia, copepods, that kind of stuff. But by the end of, towards the end of the summer, the first growing season, they were already starting to feed on yellow perch larva. And it was interesting because there was a lot of variation from year to year because of the growth rate and the temperature and everything else. So how quick, you know, if these walleye grew faster, they would get to the point where they can actually start feeding on these other fish quicker. And we had cases where if we had a very slow growth because of a cooler summer and everything, they would not get to feed till much later. This is actually an important point to also think about because we think that, you know, if the fish, the young of the year walleye, did not get to the sufficient large size by the end of the growing season, their chances of survival through the winter would diminish. So there's a balance there where, you know, if the water temperature and conditions are way too warm, you know, that it's actually would be detrimental, that could be a problem. And if it's too cool, it's a problem the other way. So somewhere in the middle, if conditions were, you know, within a certain acceptable bounds, you would see walleye grow to a certain size. And we had a pretty good idea what the size needed to be by the end of the first year for them to survive. And so, yes, the presence of perch is extremely important there because suppose you lost, something happened to the perch and you lost a year class, you know, well, obviously that would have a direct impact on the walleye, right? So we definitely saw a close correlation there between walleye, you know, there's definitely a strong prey predator-prey relationship there.
I'm going to jump in ahead of you here too, Liam, because it kind of follows up another question I wanted to ask Nick. He and Peter Colby, Dr. Peter Colby, literally wrote the book on walleye and walleye behavior. And I always remember Nick talking with Peter, and he was anglers, walleye anglers, you often hear them early in the season saying, man, there's a proliferation of male walleyes still around the spawning areas, kind of 15, 16, 17-inch fish. But it's hard. You got to weed through them to maybe see a bigger female. And I always remember Peter telling me that female walleyes generally, often in lakes, especially in lakes with ciscos, retreat from the spawning areas much, much faster than anglers ever imagine. And I said, Peter, where do they go? And he said, out to the main lake areas, main lake points, main lake reefs, etc. And he said, the reason they do that is kind of two or threefold. Number one, they can reduce their body temperature. So they, in fact, devote more energy to egg production. But he said it's also to take advantage of ciscos. and they feed heavily, much earlier in the season than anglers ever realize on cisco. And again, that comes back to our point, how amazingly adaptable this animal is.
Yeah, no, you're right. Well, that's exactly the way it's working, what Pete was telling you, because generally speaking, the behavior of spawning fish, I mean, when you look at, if you start to monitor the spawning grounds, males are always there long before the females, and they're there long after. We used to say, you know, they're just males, they're dumb enough to do that. you know what males are like, right? And but you know, I think there's some probably important survival adaptive strategies, because the females are the ones, obviously, that are the, you know, the crucial part, and you know, that probably the system is kind of built to make sure that the males are sufficiently mature and ready to fertilize the eggs, you know, when the females come in. Because I suspect that, and again, this is just conjecture on my part, but it's a pretty good conjecture based on years looking at this. But I think the cues for females are probably more narrow than males. So the females could probably come in. Males will come in over periods of time, but the females, they tend to come in a more constrained time frame. So I think the male, you want to make sure that there's enough males before and after, so that when the females come in, because I think the conditions that determine when the females come in are probably more narrow than the males, right? So I think it all plays out kind of in the adaptive behavior, that why the males are there before and after. And you're right, because we find the females, they spawn, they lay their eggs, and there's no reason for them to be there. They just went through a big energetic cost. They lost a lot of energy. If you think that the eggs, you know, I looked at this right from the beginning of egg production. I mean, they start to form even part of the summer. You know, sometimes you catch fish, I don't know if you see the little egg in there, and then by the time the fall comes, the number of eggs is pretty much set, and then they just kind of a slow development where they get bigger and bigger to the point where they're released. So there's been a huge energy cost to the fish. We used to use an index called gonadosomatic index, which essentially, gonadal means the gonads, somatic is the body, so it is the ratio between the body weight and the weight of the gonads, because they give you an idea of the energy cost. In other words, per kilogram of fish, what was the proportion that was devoted to eggs, right? And also give you a good understanding of how it varied and some of the things that determine it. So once the eggs are broadcast on the spawning grounds, you're right, the females, they just went through this huge energetic cost. They go where there's cooler water, because the waters in the spawning grounds, they will start to warm up. They're warming up by this time. And in a lake where we have ciscos, which are preferred one, and Savannah, we have some huge ciscos. I mean, I remember seeing some ciscos there, and you know, a couple of kilograms, you know, like, which is incredible, some of the cisco we had there.
Wow.
And there's another paper actually that Pete and a couple other guys put together, where they look at growth rates of walleye in lakes with cisco and without cisco. And when you get to about 30 centimeter as a walleye, you're in the position where you can start feeding on some of these larger cisco, and the growth just takes off again, you know, in other growth stances. So that's well documented as well. So yeah, that's correct, Gord. So they go there in terms of, it's an energetics, based on energetic behavior, that's based on energetic rules. And also to take advantage of some of the more nutritious food, because you're not going to get a lot of nutrition from some of the littoral, you know, you don't have a lot of food in the littoral zone and the shallow zone yet. So these larger fish that are in the deeper water, they're much more attractive, more beneficial to the large females.
Wow. Did you, just to clarify, say a couple pound Cisco, like almost 5 pounds,
kilograms? Yeah, we had, I'd have to go back and look at the actual size. They were huge. That's they, cool. I tell you, they made some beautiful smoked fish. And no, we had some pretty big, I think there was just the perfect kind of system where you had high zooplankton production. You know, the lakes is fairly shallow.
Yeah.
And, you know, well-managed population. We didn't have anglers to worry about. yeah, just conditions were. But we looked at some other lakes as well, you know, around the area that were open to fishing. Ours are sanctuary lakes, you know, they were closed to fishing. Just as a comparison, every so often when we had time, we go look at some other ones. And there was some, what was the name of the lake? There was another lake coming into that road there, Gordy might know, Dexter Lake. I don't know if you remember it, but just off the highway. And very similar to Savannah. And and their Cisco were also quite large, you know.
Yeah.
And
Nick, that raises another question, and it's a chart of Pete's that I've used when you and he wrote the synopsis of walleye for the United Nations. One of the most amazing charts was prey size and the fact that walleyes will eat prey and in fact almost prefer prey 45% of their total body length. And it always amazes me because anglers are using little tiny minnows, like inch long minnows. And I remember the chart, and I think for a 19-inch walleye, a 19-inch walleye has no trouble and in fact almost prefers eating 6, 7, 8-inch long baits. And so when you transpose that out to, say, a 30-inch walleye, it actually implies that a 30-inch walleye has no trouble and almost prefers targeting, say, 9 and 10-inch suckers. And walleye anglers rarely use baits that big.
I know. I got to make the mental math because I'm always thinking in centimeters. It just don't mean anything to me anymore. But the only thing I would say about that, Gordon, no, you're right. I mean, if you look at the graph of species, but I think we have to make just a qualification there. There's a difference between, you know, the ability of fish of a certain size to eat fish of a certain size, and there's a difference in terms of preference, because that preference a lot of times depends on availability and what's there. And as we said before, you know, fish are highly adaptable, you know, because they don't want people to walk away, oh, if we don't have that size fish, that's it, that's the end of it. No, it's not. And the other thing is that curve you're talking about, there's a line and then there's a range of sizes. There's actually fish bigger than that and smaller than that. So, you know, having said that, yes, they're able to eat fish that size, but you know better than me, being an angler more than I am, sometimes, how many times have I caught fish the same size as the lure? You know, I might have a 6-inch spoon and you get, especially if they're pike, you know, but walleye as well, you know, something, you know, they'll respond to some cue in the water, you know, a flash or whatever to go after. They may not have been able to judge the size accordingly, maybe just the way they saw, you know. So there's so many things that are kind of potential. But no, you're right, because they are able to eat fish the size. And I've seen some incredible things. You know, sometimes I've seen, not just with walleye, but other fish as well. You see, you know, this caudal fin sticking out of the throat, that you wonder, how the heck did they get this in there, you know?
Yeah.
And and again, availability or prey is a big thing. And I mean, we talked, and I don't want to take too much of your time here, but Charlie Lake, which is the lake, it's a fascinating, right? I told you about it. You know, it was lake that was, while I were introduced back in the 50s and everything else after that, for decades, all the walleye fed on here was the plankton, right? The Daphnia. When I came here, that's what they were feeding on. Their stomach were full. But also I noticed that the walleye were maxing out around 40 centimeters. So if you get a 40 centimeter walleye, it could be 6 years old or it could be 16 years old.
Wow.
You know, essentially. It's incredible, right?
Yeah, wow.
And I wonder, you know, and I took that observation to Perkis 3 in Wisconsin there. And, you know, I tried to share that as many people as I could, wrote about it, and could not find anywhere else in the walleye world that I know of where this situation was occurring. I mean, we all know about walleye feeding on mayflies, you know, certain times and all the rest of it, but we're talking about mature, older walleye with teeth, you know, they're feeding on plankton. They're not built for that, right? And I'll never forget, I mean, we were doing some index netting in the fall with a good friend of mine here, a biologist. He works down at Vancouver Island now. But and I looked down the throat of a walleye, and I saw the tail of a minnow, you know. And I said, what the heck, you know, is going on? You know, it's the first time ever. And so whatever, I mean, we can only speculate, right? What kind, because you've had these prey species in this lake for as long as the walleye were there, mostly because everything was introduced. The only fish that were there to begin with, I think, was sucker and maybe stickleback. I forget which other one. And then they brought in perch and walleye. And it's a very productive walleye fishery. You know, it's one of the best ones I've been on. And so whatever triggered, and again, I don't know if it was a behavioral thing, you know, somehow they learned that, oh, we got all this prey, maybe we should go after them, you know. And I'm really curious now because I got a biologist that's here now. He's done some recent surveys and waiting for some of the aging data to come back. And I'm really curious to see if it's impacted the growth rate. I always thought we should put Cisco in here, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, it would be tremendous, but good luck trying to get that permission through government. And but I thought, you know, the risk was non-existent and none, because, you know, there's so much food for the Cisco here. It's not like the Cisco would have thrown out of balance of predator population, you know, and I think it would have provided a really good food source for the larger wild. We could have probably a trophy walleye fishery, my guess is. But anyways, so that's to me, it's one of the best examples that I know of how adaptable, you know, all the rules, you know, we find something fascinating just because it's the first time we've seen it. You know, that doesn't mean that it hasn't been there to begin with, right? It's just fascinating to me or you because, oh, I never seen this before. Well, that doesn't mean anything. Well, it means something, but you know what I mean? Like it's not, it may be more common than we know. It's just that we never bothered to look. And I would have never predicted. I don't know anybody would have ever predicted that I could tell them there's an adult walleye population thriving here that's feeding on Daphnia. I mean, in their stomach. Yeah. So you're thinking of a walleye with teeth. How are they getting enough of this plankton to fill their stomach? I mean, they're swimming with their mouth open like whales. You know, it's just not the behavior, right? And for them to actively go after them, it seems like a hell of a lot of energy that they would have to put into this to get this. So it's a fascinating thing, right?
I mean, that's a huge spectrum. Well, on one side of the scale, you have a fish eating almost half of its length, and then the other side, it's
exactly. So I mentioned that just to kind of take us back to the idea that so we don't confuse preference versus availability, right? Because the walleye are capable of eating this size and that size fish, but I wouldn't just say, oh, that's the preferred one, right? Because a lot of it depends on what's available and the energy costs. But I defy anybody that can do energetics work to explain to me in physics and energetics how all I can, you know, what kind of energy would they have had to put in to get enough daphnia. Like, you know, just I just can't comprehend how they would have got, you know, ate enough daphnia to satisfy the needs. I mean, they were all well-fed walleye, right?
Yeah.
Are daphnia, just to clarify, are they plankton?
They're plankton, yeah, zooplankton. They're the small ones. You can see them kind of in the naked eye swimming around. People call them water fleas, whatever it may be. But with the magnifying glass, you can see they have they're kind of almost like a half moon shape with a little dot, the eye. And they have a couple of legs with filament-like feet. And typically you can see algae inside their stomach when you cave, you know, because they're pretty transparent. And typically, you know, juvenile fish, you know, feed on those. And of course, a lot of salmonids and stuff. But adult walleye?
Yeah, the amount that they would need to eat of those, like, for people who don't know, I would say they're a similar size to a flax seed. Is that about right?
Yeah, I guess small flax seed.
Yeah, like, they're tiny, maybe even smaller.
I mean,
tiny,
we're talking
like
about a millimeter, right? Millimeter or two at the most.
Exactly. Yeah. The amount that they would need to eat, well, that actually explains, you were saying that a lot of the fish that are eating that daphnia diet are very old for their size, relatively.
Yeah, and I've looked in on the stomach, and there's no mistake. I mean, the stomach was just packed with these daphnia, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, like, just on the complete opposite side of the spectrum, I've caught... This is kind of fluky, but I've caught an 18-inch walleye trolling in the fall on a 10-inch crankbait. But, I mean, like, that obviously is a bit of a fluke, but it's not uncommon for us to catch that size of fish on 6-7-inch swim baits. And mind you, we do that all of the time.
Yeah, I know how anglers, I know exactly the way anglers talk. You know, when they catch something memorable, it's skill, and something else, it's a fluke, right?
That's the way it works, Nick.
Exactly.
Listen, I've come full circle. I was bugging you when I worked in the policy side at M&R. I used to come up there, and that was my sanctuary to get out of the.
I could tell when you keep your sanity, right?
And here we are. Coming back, yeah. and we've driven you crazy for the past hour.
No, I was crazy to begin with. You have to be crazy to get into this. It helps.